Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Almost 50 years ago, in April 1968, CBS newsman Walter Cronkite delivered the shocking news that Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. Today, a half century later, Martin Luther King is honored as a civil rights leader, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, with a federal holiday bearing his name. But our guest today says in the late 60s, King was also a controversial figure, and the varied reactions across America to his killing reflects that. This hour in The Exchange, we're talking with the author of a forthcoming book that presents this What Happened After story, how the nation and the world responded in the days and decades after the King assassination. UNH history professor Jason Sokol joins us. His book is titled The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And Jason, welcome to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Great to be here with you, Laura.
Well, there are so many books about, you know, the life and legacy of a famous person. This one, Jason, as I said, is subtitled The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Why did you decide to approach it from this perspective, Jason, the What Happened After story?
Well, we have many wonderful biographies of Martin Luther King written by people like Taylor Branch, David Garrow, David Levering Lewis. Many of those books, you know, end quite reasonably. They end when King's life ended on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. What I wanted to do was to try to understand how King's death and assassination impacted the rest of the nation and the world. So basically, my book starts where a lot of the other books left off. And in that way, I can try to assess King's real impact and meaning on our country.
So this is less a portrait, Jason, of King and his work, and more a portrait of the country, how it reacted and why.
That's right. And the country reacted in a wide variety of ways. I mean, thinking about King now in 2018, one might assume that King's assassination in 1968 was just thought of as a sort of national tragedy, but it wasn't thought of that way by everyone. There were certainly many African Americans and liberal whites who mourned King's death. There were also white people who celebrated quite openly. And there were millions of more white people who just thought of the assassination of King as sort of another inconvenience or another thing to navigate and didn't see it as this huge catastrophe at the time.
They just kind of hoped it would blow over and go away. Which, as you tell us, it did not. Yeah, go ahead.
That's right. I mean, many white people thought of this as a tragedy for black people, but not for themselves, not for the whole country. For instance, in Atlanta, where King was from, and where King's funeral was held, all of the downtown stores were closed on the day of the funeral in Atlanta. But on the outskirts of the city, you know, there were people doing their regular Easter shopping, living their regular everyday lives, and not really seeing it as an enormous important thing to take time to mourn and grieve for the fallen leader.
And as you say, Jason, there's been a lot of, you know, excellent work done chronicling the life of Martin Luther King. Your book starts where most of those books leave off. What did you learn researching this that you think might surprise many listeners and that maybe surprised you? you know, covering it from this different angle?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things I've learned. As I alluded to, one thing was the depths of white hostility to King at the time of his death. Now King in the last year of his life, we're talking 1967-68, had become perceived as a real radical. And he was a real radical. I mean, he raised his voice against the Vietnam War many times. He criticized American foreign policy and Lyndon Johnson's waging of the war. In return, many journalists and mainstream political leaders denounced and criticized King. That was number one. And number two, King was starting to wage the Poor People's Campaign, which was his last great social movement, his last crusade. And with the Poor People's Campaign, he envisioned millions of impoverished Americans, Black and white and Latino Americans of every race. He envisioned that they would march on Washington and bring the Capitol, bring life in the Capitol to a halt, and that they would dramatize the issue of poverty and economic injustice. Now, a lot of Americans looked at this and said, he's a socialist, he's a communist, he's a left-wing lunatic. So at this time, King was hated and reviled by a segment of the American public.
And that was surprising to you. You didn't realize the depths of that.
I didn't realize the depths of that. I mean, certainly we know that he was seen as an agitator by whites in the Jim Crow South. But one of the shocking things I found was the fact that King was reviled not only in the South, but across the country. I have letters from people in Chicago, in Boston, in Michigan, in the Bronx, all of them saying, you know what, good riddance.
That's pretty harsh.
It is harsh.
I was surprised by that, too, when I read the book, that people openly said, yeah, good riddance.
Yeah, and so that, you know, that is jarring from our current perspective, because King is currently seen as a hero. You know, white children are taught to idolize him. Black children are taught to idolize him. So we don't necessarily think of that from this perspective.
Go ahead, Jason.
You know, I want to say that I didn't only learn that he was hated. I also learned the degree to which he was loved and revered. The other common narrative about King at the end of his life is that, a lot of Black people started to think of him as somewhat irrelevant, because in 1967-68, the civil rights movement itself had split into a lot of different factions. And, you know, one of those factions was Black Power, which was a more radical cry, with some African Americans embracing violence, or if not violence, embracing a sort of militancy. And you had Martin Luther King, who still clung to nonviolence. As much as his views on war and poverty might have evolved over the time of his career, he clung to nonviolence throughout. And because of that, a lot of the younger Black people started to think that King was no longer relevant. Well, what I found, though, people reflecting on King after his death, was that he was really loved and revered by a large segment of the African-American population. They didn't just see him as a political leader dying. Many people felt as though a member of their family had been killed. They had these profound and deep emotions and feelings about him after his death that maybe some of them hadn't even realized during his life.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us, and then so much more to dig into, Jason. The number for you to join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today, we're talking with UNH history professor Jason Sokol. His forthcoming book looks at the nation's reaction in the days and decades after Martin Luther King's assassination. It's called The Heavens Might Crack: The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And Jason, you know, African Americans listening might be thinking, well, no surprise to us that, you know, some whites thought that King was a troublemaker and were glad he was gone. But you do say that there were other groups of people who also revered Martin Luther King. You know, it wasn't just, you know, whites thought he was a troublemaker and blacks thought he was wonderful. I mean, there's a lot more nuance than that.
Yeah, there is a lot more nuance than that. I mean, for instance, on college campuses throughout the nation, King's assassination sparked great protests and demonstrations everywhere from Wisconsin to Duke to Texas to Columbia. So college students, many of whom had been actively protesting the Vietnam War, well, in the wake of King's death, they started a sort of reawakening to the extent of racial injustice in America and started waging protests and demonstrations against that. In addition, one other thing I found was that King was an international leader, a global leader. The emotions, the outpouring after his death was not confined to the borders of our country, but he was revered in Africa, throughout Europe, in Asia, in the Caribbean. So one thing that I did find that was striking was the degree to which the effects of his death and also the effects of his life had sort of rippled across the seas and enveloped the whole globe.
You mentioned the protests and riots that broke out on college campuses, and we'll talk about what happened in some of America's cities as well. But in those immediate hours afterwards, what was the reaction by political leaders? You know, President Johnson, for example, and other people at the top levels of our society. How did they react?
Yeah, this is interesting because just a few days before his death, many political leaders had been denouncing King, even on the floor of the United States Senate.
Really?
Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia stood on the floor of the Senate in that week preceding King's death and called him a troublemaker because of the marches he was leading in Memphis. King was in Memphis at the time of his death, and he was assisting striking sanitation workers, and he was leading marches in that city. Well, in one of the marches King led, some of the people behind him turned to violence. In response, senators and congressmen stood in the Capitol and gave speeches criticizing him. Well, then after his death, a lot of them, said that they mourned for King and they grieved for him. But also what a lot of them said was they didn't want the country to riot. And that's what LBJ said. He got on, he made a televised address, President Johnson did, the night of King's death. And Johnson said, you know, we grieve for King, but also we should make sure to honor him by practicing nonviolence.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that. I've got a little clip of that speech that you just mentioned. Again, President Johnson speaking to the nation, saying, you know, once again, the heart of America weeps. And as you said, Jason, urging restraint. Let's hear.
The life of a man who symbolized the freedom and faith of America has been taken. But it is the fiber and the fabric of the republic that's being tested. If we are to have the America that we mean to have, all men of all races, all regions, all religions must stand their ground to deny violence its victory in this sorrowful time and in all times to come.
Again, President Lyndon Johnson speaking to the nation in a broadcast from the White House right after Martin Luther King was assassinated almost 50 years ago. So go ahead, Jason, your thoughts after hearing that clip of LBJ.
Yeah, I mean, in part, Johnson was responding to what was already happening in many of the big cities. Washington was erupting. African-Americans were beginning riots there. And you know, King himself had a complicated relationship to these urban rebellions. King once called riots, quote unquote, the language of the unheard. So King understood the despair that was at the root of these urban uprisings in a way that somebody like Johnson may not have. Johnson and King also had a very complex relationship by the end of King's life. You know, the two of them had worked rather closely in 1964 and 65, had worked on the passage of civil rights legislation, Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act. But by 67, 68, Johnson was not really mourning the passing of an ally. I mean, Johnson was enraged by King's criticism of the Vietnam War. So I mean, you can hear that in the tone, I think, of Johnson's speech, that he's not, it's not a speech where he's grieving this for this great leader, but he just wants to make sure that there's not uprisings across America.
Let's go to our listeners, Jason, their questions and your remembrances of this time. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, today we're looking at a forthcoming book by UNH history professor Jason Sokol. It looks at the nation's reaction to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And Dave joins us from Henniker. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I was just in Memphis about a month or two ago and went to the motel where Martin Luther King died. And there's a museum now, a Black History Essential Museum, in that motel. And yet there's a person that's been protesting that location of that for like 9 years now, a Black woman who stands out in the corner. She wants people to be more aware of the fact that there's this museum and have it more downtown rather than this predominantly Black neighborhood. But the thing I remember about Martin Luther King's antagonism towards a lot of people back in the 60s was that he had started to focus on Northern racism, and that bothered a lot of people. And then he started focusing on the injustice of the Vietnam War. And a lot of people just said, you know, stick to your own issue. Well, the whole thing was his issue. And it just bothered a lot more people by the time he was shot.
Very interesting, Dave. Thank you for the call. You know, Jason, it's interesting that he mentions Northern white racism because that was kind of the subject of your last book, right? So I'd love for you to tie that in for us. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Yeah, the subject of my last book was racism in the North. And the caller is exactly right. I mean, in 1966... King decided to wage a protest against housing segregation in Chicago. And King actually, he and his family went and lived in what we would call a sort of slum apartment in Chicago. And he wanted to highlight this issue of housing segregation. Now, King found that this issue was, in a way, harder to tackle and to solve than the issues in the South had been. Because in Chicago, he wasn't up against these sort of head-bashing sheriffs that he had been against in Selma and Birmingham, but he was against Mayor Richard Daley, who was the head of the powerful, you know, Chicago Democratic machine. And what did Daley say? He said, oh, okay, well, we will pass a few reforms on housing and we'll take care of this. And actually, King didn't make much headway. So what King found was that the problems in the North were, in a way, much more difficult to solve. And he was dealing with all these interrelated issues of poverty and housing, along with just sort of old-fashioned racism.
Dave, thanks for the call. And after a short break, Jason, we'll talk more. I'm interested in the global reaction that you write about in your book, reaction to Martin Luther King's assassination around the world. Also, some of the political changes that happened after Martin Luther King was murdered. And we'll take more of your calls, emails. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call like Dave did, 1-800-892-6477.
Hi, my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. A forthcoming book by a UNH history professor paints a picture of America reacting to Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination almost 50 years ago in April of 68. The book is called The Heavens Might Crack. Let's get you into our conversation with the author Jason Sokol. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Jason, in the book, you call Martin Luther King's assassination a, quote, tipping point in American racial history. So describe that for us, please.
That's right. I think that in the early and mid-1960s, many people in America had the belief that the country was making progress in terms of solving racial injustice and passing legislation at the national level. Jim Crow in the South was being battered and beaten down and eradicated. By the later 1960s, the atmosphere was much less harmonious and much more chaotic. You had, on the one hand, you had Black Power activists saying that they weren't just after legal change, but that they wanted change in everyday life. And then you had some whites, on the other hand, people like George Wallace, whipping up resentment against the civil rights movement. So by the end of the 1960s, you didn't really have many Americans believing that all these problems could be solved anymore, but that we might be forever fractured into our own groups and that there might not be a way for America to make itself a sort of interracial whole again. And I think the assassination of King maybe put out that final flicker of hope for a multiracial America. Well, the assassination of King just sort of extinguished that and acted as a punctuation mark on all of these strands of American society that seemed to be coming apart at that moment.
Well, you also write that there was a sense, especially among young African Americans, that this killing permanently closed the door on King's ideal of nonviolence. You quote Black Panther's chair Bobby Seale as saying, "Our brother Martin Luther King exhausted all means of nonviolence." How widespread was this feeling, Jason, of, you know, forget it, this didn't work, look what happened to him, time to move on to armed conflict?
Yeah, it's a good question, how widespread was the feeling? I mean, I think still the large majority of African Americans were committed to nonviolence and to peaceful approaches. But in the wake of King's death, the activists who touted much more militant philosophies and organizations, they gathered great steam. I mean, you can trace the national rise and expansion of the Black Panther Party. You can trace that almost directly to King's assassination. Before King's death, the Black Panther Party, and you just quoted Bobby Seale, one of the leaders of the party. Before King's death, the Black Panther Party, it did have a national profile because they were gaining headlines, but they really only had headquarters and operations in California. Well, after King's death and during the rest of 1968, more than a dozen headquarters sprouted in cities all across the nation. So I think, with King's death, Black people said, you know what? We tried nonviolence. In fact, Martin Luther King tried so hard for nonviolence. And if he's going to be killed by white racists, then what hope is there for his philosophy? And so I think a lot of people, African-Americans in particular, said, you know, his way didn't work. And the killing of King was proof positive that his way didn't work, and we need to try something more militant if we're ever going to get our fair share in America.
You know, Jason, I have to ask you this, and it's a bit of a side from our narrative, but as we talk about this, we're saying some African-Americans responded this way, some responded this way, some whites mourned, some whites said, glad he's off the stage. How do you, as a white person, approach telling these stories when, you haven't by any means live the struggle, so to speak? There's a lot of talk about this these days.
Yeah, it's a good question, Laura. And I understand the concerns of those who would, who would question the authenticity or commitment of a white person who wants to tell the history and stories of Black people. I've basically devoted my career to writing histories of the civil rights movement. And what I think is that I think all white Americans should be interested in African American history, should be interested and concerned for racial justice. And so, to me, I think it's a conversation that white people should enter into honestly and fully, even though there are, of course, legitimate questions about who's telling the story and for what purpose.
Let's take another call, Jason. And this is Helen in Wanalancet. Hi, Helen. Thanks for calling in today. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I was in high school in the late 50s and early 60s, and our parents, I thought, were ahead of their time and really wanted us to understand all peoples. And I remember not having my eyes wide open, but not really knowing much. And there was a Black man named Bill in our school that was so handsome. I'll never forget him. Almost scary handsome. And when we went on to college, we also had a huge variety of students. And so I think in education, there was a different thing.
So Helen, what's your point about the book and how the nation reacted to King's assassination?
I really feel that he was more of a leader than perhaps is coming forth here. I heard him speak, and he had presence. When he was killed, it was after a series, and we were a bit numbed. I think everything changed when JFK was killed. But I heard him speak, and he had presence. And I think, knowing how scared Black people were in the South, that he gave them the strength to move forward. I think we were just somewhat ignorant. But the Black people in Alabama were terrified of trying to do anything, and they were willing to because of him.
Well, Helen, thank you. And, you raised this in the book, Jason, the idea that Martin Luther King, in his life and after his death, inspired many generations of new civil rights activists. So I'd love your thoughts there as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he certainly did. I mean, your question is about future generations, Laura?
Yeah, I think in the book you say that, of course, during his life, Martin Luther King inspired others. But after his death, a whole new generation of civil rights leaders was inspired and born, in the days and decades afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, in the days after his death, there's plenty of stories of people who hadn't really committed themselves to social justice before his death. This I'm talking about everybody from, middle-aged white Southerners to old Black laborers. They said, I haven't really done anything for social justice yet. And the killing of this great leader says to me that I have to go and sort of sacrifice and maybe resist. And King also inspired many future generations. For instance, Barack Obama always looked back to King as one of his sort of idols or models when Obama was beginning his work in community organizing and activism. So I think it's no stretch at all to say that for years and decades beyond his death, King did inspire legions of people.
Well, we've got a little clip of former President Obama talking about what you just mentioned, Jason. Here he is as a U.S. Senator from Illinois, speaking at the 2006 groundbreaking ceremony for the MLK Memorial in D.C. And at this event, he talked about what King meant to him, but also how he hoped King would inspire future generations, mentioning what he'll tell his daughters about Martin Luther King. Let's hear.
From that this man tried to love somebody. I will tell them that because he did these things, they live today with the freedom God intended, their citizenship unquestioned, their dreams unbounded. And I will tell them that they too can love, that they too can serve, and that each generation is beckoned anew to fight for what is right and to strive for what is just.
Again, that's former President Obama speaking at the groundbreaking ceremony for the Martin Luther King Memorial back in 2006. The book we're talking about today is called The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. It looks at what happened after Martin Luther King's assassination. It's by UNH history professor Jason Sokol, and we're taking your questions and comments as well. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Jason, when people look at what happened after Martin Luther King's assassination, the riots that you mentioned get a lot of attention, you know, Baltimore, D.C., other cities, but especially those two and several others. But there were peaceful protests and civic and political engagement, too, that came out of this. You touched on it when you were talking about President Obama and others, but how much did that step up, Jason, after the assassination?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was easy for the peaceful protests to get lost amid the headlines and the sort of TV highlights of the rioting in the streets. You know, that's what everybody saw at the time, was the rioting in the streets because it was publicized. But there were, you know, waves and waves of public protests, thousands of people marching in New York City from Central Park, all the way down Fifth Avenue, 25,000 people, equal numbers of black and white, marching in Newark, New Jersey, which was also scarred by riots, and on college campuses all throughout the nation. I alluded to Duke University just a little bit, but, you know, Duke University was, during the 60s, still thought of as a pretty conservative Southern institution. And after King's death, a lot of these white students began to wage what they called a silent vigil, and they took their sleeping bags out to the main quad, and some 1,500 students were drawn into the protests. And one of their main demands of the Duke silent vigil was that the non-academic employees at the university, so we're talking here about the janitors, the cafeteria workers, many of whom were impoverished African Americans, you know, the demands of the Duke silent vigil were that these workers be paid better, were that they receive collective bargaining rights. So I think, you know, this was a serious protest with serious goals. It wasn't just white kids feeling bad and sort of, you know, romping down the street. It was them trying to affect change in their community, at their institution. So, you know, social change didn't have to come in these huge national ways. No, it more often comes in our own communities and local places. And in the wake of King's assassination, a lot of white people thought about, you know, how can I help to affect change locally? And that's just one example of what's in the book.
Did the janitors and cafeteria workers get better working conditions after that Duke protest?
Well, yes and no. They did get, their salaries were raised, and that within 1 year. By 1969, their salaries were raised. Duke, at the time, as a nonprofit institution at the time, it did not have to adhere to federal minimum wage requirements. So the workers were paid less than federal minimum wage. And one of the demands by the students was that the workers be paid at least federal minimum wage. And the university did indeed implement that change. Now, on the question of collective bargaining rights and union rights, that was much more touchy. And a lot of that was because the trustees of Duke University, no surprise, were some of these textile barons in North Carolina. And these were men who had been anti-union all their lives. And they didn't want to really budge on the idea of union membership. So it took much longer for that change to be affected.
Interesting. All right, back to our listeners. Christopher is calling in from Concord. Hi, Christopher. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. So, Jason, I haven't read your book yet, but it seems very interesting. I would like to pick it up when I have a free minute.
It's forthcoming anyway. So forthcoming in March. So go ahead.
Oh, right, of course. I've been listening probably for the last half hour, and I wanted to discuss not so much King's assassination, but how he was interpreted during his most famous days, specifically Birmingham in 1963. I was a loyal patron of Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, and I'm sure that several listeners are on a similar boat. And one of his episodes was about the famous picture of the leaping dog, German Shepherd, called the Foot Soldier of Birmingham. And Gladwell is always accused of taking a rosy-hued interpretation of history.
So what's your question for Jason, Christopher?
My question is, I guess, how, in your research, did you find things similar to what Gladwell described of the picture worth a thousand words and different interpretations of history?
Sure. Well, thank you.
Removed from it.
Yeah, and definitely it's a process. And you talk about this in the book, Jason, you know, the process of Martin Luther King Jr. being, you know, a controversial figure, beloved in some quarters, criticized, as you said, you know, in others, including in the halls of the U.S. Congress, to this image that we have today. I think you call it scrubbed and polished. I'm not sure if I'm quoting you exactly directly, Jason, but our caller's right. There's this sort of evolution of the image. So I'd love your thoughts there.
Yeah, and I think the evolution of the image, of King's image, so this was one of the things that started immediately after King's death. Like I said before, King was criticized and denounced by many political leaders in his last months and weeks and days. Well, after his death, they turned around and they almost immediately started lauding him and honoring him as this hero who was interested in nonviolence and interracialism and colorblindness. And I think a lot of mainstream political leaders conveniently left out a number of King's other causes, which were the anti-war effort, the effort against poverty, the effort for economic justice. And so immediately after King himself passed away, there was this skirmish over, you know, how his legacy would be interpreted and which of King's legacies would be elevated. And that, you know, over the years and the decades, there was this process of Americans battling over which King we would celebrate. And when the federal Martin Luther King holiday finally came about in 1986, while the legislation was actually passed in 83, the holiday first celebrated in 86, you know, Ronald Reagan was president. And he celebrated King as a sort of rugged individualist. He said King was one, an individual who thought that people in America should be able to rise as great as their ability would allow them. So Reagan and the holiday sort of capped off this battle over what image of King we would honor.
Well, and coming up, we should talk about the evolution of this Martin Luther King holiday and the debate. And there's a New Hampshire angle to this, since we were the last state to adopt the holiday. Also, we should definitely talk, Jason, about Martin Luther King Jr. as a global figure, because that's real interesting. And that's in the book as well. So all that's coming up. Thank you for the call, Christopher. And we'll be back in a minute. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how America reacted to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., both immediately and in the years after. That's what a new book by UNH professor examines. We're finding out more. The author is Jason Sokol. The book is called The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And Jason, just before the break, we were talking about the evolution of this Martin Luther King holiday. And I want to play a little clip of then-Governor Jeanne Shaheen observing the fact that New Hampshire finally signed the holiday into law in 1999. Let's just hear a little bit of that.
Today is his historic day. Today is the day we are, after 20 years, going to add Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s name to our civil rights.
So there, Jason, she says, we're going to add it. This was a state-by-state process, right? Just remind us how that rolled out.
Yeah, I mean, well, right after King's death, you had congressmen in Washington offering legislation for a federal King holiday. And that was not enacted, like I said, until the 1980s. But what you had starting in the early 70s was state by state, each state decided whether they wanted to enact a state Martin Luther King holiday. And some of the more liberal states that you might expect, Connecticut, Illinois, Massachusetts, started to pass these state bills in the early 70s, until by the late 90s, well, by 1999, you had every state except New Hampshire having a Martin Luther King Day. And some of those battles were quite intense. For instance, in the state of Arizona, one Arizona governor proclaimed a Martin Luther King Day in 1986, while the next incoming governor rescinded it. And then you had ballot propositions. Voters would vote on whether they wanted a state King holiday. Well, early in the 90s, the voters of Arizona voted that they didn't want a holiday. And then a few years later, they voted that they did. So this was a contested and bruising process, yeah, state by state at the local level, in terms of would people honor Martin Luther King and by what means.
Why was that the case? I mean, it's interesting because your whole book is about the reactions after and how varied they were. So what do you pull out of these state-by-state discussions, battles, debates, call them what you will, over this holiday?
Yeah, a lot of it often came down to how King was framed. So I alluded to Arizona. For instance, some people, a lot of white people in Arizona, thought of King as a sort of troublemaker, even decades after his death. You know, that part of the King legacy was what persisted in Arizona. And that state didn't pass the holiday until activists, it was a reverend named Warren Stewart, who started to say, you know what, King really just believed in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and sort of basic things about freedom and equal rights. And finally, people in Arizona started to come around, also with a big assist by the National Football League. The NFL removed the Super Bowl from Tempe, Arizona, until the state passed a King holiday.
Oh, that's right. I remember that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And there was also Public Enemy came out with a song called By the Time I Get to Arizona, which was a very critical take on Arizona's governor. So this was a, you know, really contentious in Arizona at the time. It was also contentious in New Hampshire for many years. You know, a state holiday was first proposed in New Hampshire in 1979, and the legislature rejected that proposal pretty much every 2 years until, you know, 99, when it finally passed.
Wow. Well, another topic that we should cover that is really interesting in your book, Jason, and that is Martin Luther King as an international figure. And again, since you focus on the impact, repercussions of his death, how much this, you know, sort of swept across the world. We forget this sometimes. We get so focused on our own history. I want to play a little clip of Martin Luther King's, one of his best friends, Ralph Abernathy, speaking at the April 9th funeral. And in this clip, Ralph Abernathy alludes to King's national and also global impact. So let's hear this from the funeral.
The cemetery is too small for his spirit, but we commit his body to the ground. The grave is too narrow for his soul, but we commit his body to the ground. no coffin, no crypt, nor vault. No stone can hold his greatness, but we commit his body to the ground.
Again, that's Ralph Abernathy speaking at Martin Luther King's funeral. And so there you have it, Jason. You know, beautifully written. The cemetery is too small for his spirit. How did the spirit of Martin Luther King inspire people in countries around the world? And, you know, obviously that's a huge question. So maybe you can just pick a couple countries where he was especially revered and where his death was especially felt.
Yeah, I mean, during his life, a lot of people around the world held King up as a hero in their own causes and their own struggles. People on both sides of the Cold War saw King as a hero for their cause. King visited Berlin in 1964, a year after the Berlin Wall had been built, and he was greeted as a hero by the West Berliners, you know, who saw King as a sort of model and inspiration of freedom in the Western world. Also the East Berliners, who wanted to resist against their own oppressive system. He was also beloved in India, for instance. King was associated very closely with Gandhi and methods of pacifism and nonviolence, and also celebrated throughout Africa and the Caribbean, you know, with people of African descent. And then these sort of celebrations definitely continued after King's assassination and his death. I mean, throughout Europe, throughout Africa, people gathered in, you know, public rituals of mourning, thousands of people in many world capitals. One of the more interesting responses to King's death was also in West Germany, where King's assassination, in fact, inspired a copycat assassination attempt, where one West German tried to assassinate a student leader named Rudi Dutschke, who was a leftist, a socialist. And the perpetrator said, you know, he said he read about King's assassination and he wanted to do the same thing in Germany.
Wow.
And what that did in Germany was it was quite amazing, actually. What that did in Germany was it intensified basically a struggle between these radical student protesters and the West German government. And, of course, the issue of Vietnam was very emotional in Germany, just as in the U.S. And you know, the things that a lot of white Americans criticize King for, his sort of anti-war stance, his embrace of democratic socialism, those things made King a hero in Europe. I mean, many in Europe saw the Vietnam War as an exercise in American imperialism, and they saw King as one of the only Americans who was saying that, who was calling the war what it was.
So this is the time of a very chilly Cold War between the Soviet Union and the U.S. And you write, Jason, that the Soviet Union kind of had a field day with this, you know, describing the U.S. as a violent, racist country and saying, look at this. It just shows once again, you know, how messed up we are.
That's right. I mean, and in an international sense, America's great flaw was racial injustice. I mean, through the 1950s and 60s, America claimed it was a beacon of freedom for the world. Well, at the same time, you had Jim Crow laws, you had segregation and discrimination throughout the country. So every time that countries like the Soviet Union and East Germany, every time they saw an event tied to racism happen in the United States, they put that on their headline. Yeah, and the Soviet newspapers, the East German newspapers said, you know, King's killing shows what a terrible, violent, unjust land the U.S. is. And in some important respects, they were right.
Here's an email that just came in from TD. TD says, my question, how did Robert Kennedy relate to Dr. King? RFK's speech on the day of Dr. King's assassination is magnificent, but is there more to learn about their relationship? And TD, thank you very much for the email. Before you chime in on that, Jason, I do want to play a little bit from RFK, then a New York U.S. senator, announcing to the people of Indianapolis that MLK had been shot. So glad you raised it, TD, because we do have a little clip of that. In his remarks, Kennedy especially spoke to the anger and frustration of African Americans, but also called for a continuation of King's nonviolent ethic. Let's hear.
You can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, and greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand, compassion, and love.
Again, that's Robert F. Kennedy speaking after Martin Luther King was assassinated. TD, again, thank you for the question. What about that relationship, Jason? What do you know?
Well, I mean, it was an interesting relationship through the 60s. You know, Robert Kennedy was the head of the department. You know, he was in John F. Kennedy's administration, and John F. Kennedy had a complicated relationship with King. I mean, at first, FBI was spying on King. J. Edgar Hoover was telling Kennedy that King was a communist. At first, JFK wasn't getting involved in civil rights at all. And finally, you know, with responding to Martin Luther King's protests and repeated demonstrations, Martin Luther King drew the Kennedy administration into that civil rights struggle, and ultimately the Kennedys came down on the side of civil rights. I can also talk about that RFK speech if you want.
Sure, go ahead.
And you know, that speech is an amazing one. I mean, so Robert F. Kennedy had declared his candidacy for the Democratic nomination for president. Kennedy has declared his candidacy in March of 1968, and he hit the campaign trail, and the first big primary coming up was the Indiana primary. And so Robert Kennedy was in Indianapolis on the night of King's death. He heard about King's death. Robert Kennedy immediately flashed back, of course, to his own brother's death, was overcome with emotion.
Right.
And a lot of Kennedy's aides and the mayor, police chief told Robert Kennedy not to go out and speak at a rally. They didn't know what sort of violence might occur. Kennedy did not heed their advice. He went to the black neighborhood of Indianapolis. He spoke extemporaneously about King's death. He spoke about his own experience, you know, with death and with his brother's assassination. And he made this plea for peace and unity. And so not only the speech, but also in a larger sense, King's assassination transformed Kennedy's presidential campaign into one where Kennedy would offer himself as a candidate who could begin to heal America's racial divide. And Robert Kennedy really did appeal to African Americans, and he also appealed to white voters. And so a lot of the hopes that people, Americans, had placed in Martin Luther King, hopes for, you know, interracial unity, well, they shifted those hopes over to Robert Kennedy on the campaign trail in 1968. And then, of course, tragically, Robert Kennedy was then assassinated 2 months after King was, on June 4th.
Wow, just devastating when you think about it. And to hear you talk about, you know, people being so crushed by King's assassination, still maybe even recovering from JFK's assassination and then King's assassination. And then they start to say, okay, maybe this, you know, we can place some of these hopes and dreams in RFK, and then he's assassinated. It is, your heart just sinks when you hear this, when you remember it, even though it's, you know, we all know the history. It's not new. Just to wrap up with you, Jason, and this has been really interesting. There's a lot more we could talk about. What role has the King family itself played in preserving this image, in this what image that you describe as sculpted and scrubbed from what it was 50 years ago? What role has the family itself played?
Well, it's a sort of difficult question because I don't think the family has tried to put forth King as this idol of colorblindness in the way that some moderate and conservative white Americans have. After King's death, you know, Coretta Scott King spoke a lot about Martin as being someone who cared deeply for the poor in America and across the globe. So I think Coretta Scott King wanted Martin Luther King's work for economic justice and wanted Martin Luther King's work for world peace. You know, she wanted those things to be really main hallmarks of King's legacy. I think a lot of Americans don't instantly think about King as a sort of international leader or a leader for economic justice immediately. So to that extent, I don't think Coretta's vision of King has really carried the day.
So the civil rights message, you know, plays loud and clear, but the poverty, the anti-war, the peace, that's gotten set aside somewhat over the years, Jason?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think most of what people learn about Martin Luther King, and this definitely goes for a lot of the students that I teach at UNH, for instance, everybody knows the I Have a Dream speech, but the line that they usually know is the line where King says he hopes for a day in which his children will be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. People don't so much remember the lines where King warns that a whirlwind of revolt will come to the country if police brutality isn't ended, for instance. So he's got more radical lines even in the I Have a Dream speech, but it's a question of what we as Americans choose to highlight and remember.
Well, Jason Sokol, it's been good to talk to you again. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Laura.
As Jason Sokol, Associate Professor of History at UNH, author of the forthcoming book in March, The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Professor Sokol's also written two other books on the history of the civil rights movement. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.